You are listening to KBOO Portland.
The following program is a special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred and are no longer relevant.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying her habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals on KBOO. This is your host, Noah Bristol. Michelle Coppola and I bring you this show on the fourth Friday of every month at 10 a.m., or you can listen online anytime at kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals. Now, we're on the air to give voice to the urgent animal welfare and rights issues happening locally, regionally, and worldwide. And before we get to today's guest, first, some animal news from around the world. In Colorado, voters approved Proposition 114 to reintroduce wolves to the Rocky Mountains. These animals were hunted, trapped, and poisoned into regional extinction decades ago. Cattle ranchers and elk hunters opposed the ballot measure, but a majority of voters passed it. At the same time in Denver, two-thirds of voters overwhelmingly voted to end the city's decades-old ban on pit bulls. And Wellesley just became the first municipality in Massachusetts to ban the sale of fur, following the state of California in that decision. For some background to this next story, in 2018, Californian voters passed Proposition 12, the Prevention of Cruelty to Farm Animals Act, that bans the sale of eggs and meat not produced according to the new, more stringent standards. To abide by the new confinement standards, farmers must provide 43 square feet of floor space for calves, 24 square feet for pigs, and more than a foot for hens. This may not sound like much, but it's a greater minimum than is required for most of the country. The North American Meat Institute sued the state, claiming that the regulations should not apply to animal products produced outside of California and then shipped in for sale. U.S. District Judge Christina Snyder denied the group's request to block the law in November 2019, and recently a Ninth Circuit panel affirmed that decision during the Meat Institute's appeal. Also in California, in July of this year, U.S. District Judge Stephen V. Wilson ruled that California's 2012 ban on the sale of foie gras will not apply to products imported from out of state. McDonald's had a big unveiling this month when they revealed the McPlant, a proprietary plant-based patty that the company will be testing in select markets in 2021. McDonald's International President Ian Borden said in a statement, quote, "As we have worked to better understand customer demand, some markets around the world have tested plant-based products. Informed by those learnings, we have created a delicious burger that will be the first menu option in a plant-based platform we are calling McPlant. McPlant is crafted exclusively for McDonald's by McDonald's," end quote. On September 29th, the Bill Preventing Future Pandemics Act of 2020 was introduced to the United States Senate. This bill would establish measures to address global public health risks posed by wildlife markets, which are commercial markets that sell or slaughter wildlife for human consumption as food or medicine, in communities where alternative nutritional or protein sources are available. Lastly, pork producer Smithfield has settled on a lawsuit after a six-year legal battle with plaintiffs who had sued the company over the stench, flies, buzzards, and truck traffic coming from its industrial swine farms in North Carolina. More than 500 North Carolinians, most of them black, filed more than two dozen lawsuits in 2014. Some lived near farms that had contracts with Smithfield. Others lived near farms owned by the company outright. They described being trapped inside their homes, sickened by the smell of hog waste stored in open pits, and unable to hang laundry, cook outdoors, or entertain visitors. J. Harvey Wilkinson III, one of the judges in one of these cases, decried the, quote, outrageous conditions, end quote, at Kinlaw Farms, the operation at the center of the lawsuit. Quote, conditions that there is no reason to suppose were unique to that facility, end quote. Wilkinson also wrote, quote, how did it come to this? What was missing was the recognition that treating animals better will benefit humans. What was neglected is that animal welfare and human welfare, far from advancing at cross purposes, are actually integrally connected. The decades-long transition to concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, lays bare this connection and the consequences of its breach with startling clarity, end quote. Wilkinson described a system in which pigs were forced to live in enclosures they had outgrown, reducing them, quote, to almost suffocating closeness. The dangers endemic to such appalling conditions always manifested first in animal suffering. Ineluctably, however, the ripples of dysfunction would reach farm workers and, at last, members of the surrounding community, end quote. Wilkinson's comments were in line with the court's main opinion. Smithfield lost the first five cases that went to trial. It appealed the three largest verdicts, but in a new ruling, a three-judge panel rejected most of the pork producers' arguments. The company, quote, persisted in its chosen farming practices despite its knowledge of the harms to its neighbors, exhibiting wanton or willful disregard of the neighbors' rights to enjoyment of their property, end quote. Judge Stephanie Thacker wrote for the court. Elsie Herring, a plaintiff in another one of the cases, said she was pleased that the court had sided with the neighbors on most issues. Quote, our lives have been destroyed by the industry, end quote. Today we get to speak with Matthew Cooper, an organizer for Compassionate PDX, about Fur Free Friday and the link between the current pandemic and factory farming, especially factory farming for fur. Welcome to the show, Matthew.
Thanks, Noah.
Now you're with Compassionate PDX, which is formerly known as Fur Free PDX. Is that right?
Well, Compassionate PDX is the name of the organization, but and Fur Free PDX was the campaign to try to pass a ban on the sale of new fur products in Portland.
Understood. Thanks for clearing that up. And can you tell us about Compassionate PDX, why it was founded, and what the current aim of the organization is?
Sure. So we got started in early 2018. We're a grassroots animal rights organization focused on passing animal-friendly legislation. And we were inspired by the success of cities in California, Berkeley, San Francisco, in passing fur sales bans. So that's a ban on the sale of new fur products. We thought Portland would be a great city to do it in. We're very animal-friendly here, and there's not many fur stores. So that campaign went on for a couple years. We got 4,800 signatures. We got 50 businesses on board. But, you know, since the pandemic and the social unrest, the city's gone into lockdown. So more recently, we've been shifting focus to the state level. Our legislation is based on the fur sales ban that passed in California last year. So far, three state representatives have sponsored our legislation, and we're continuing to build momentum with Fur Free Friday.
Hey, that's amazing. That's exciting news.
It wasn't a very hard sell as far as the animal rights angle. And they were really, I think, surprised to hear about the connection to the pandemic as well, and what's happening over in Europe.
Fur Free Friday, tell us about that.
So Fur Free Friday, it's an annual day of action for fur-bearing animals. It is national. It's been held across the United States since 1986. And it's been going on in Portland for at least 16 years.
And usually there is a demonstration downtown and a march downtown. And there have been, throughout the years in Portland, as I understand, various developments and victories. Can you tell us a little bit about the local history of the event and some of its accomplishments so far?
Yeah, sure. So there are no stores left in Portland that only sell fur. The last one was Schumacher's, which closed down a little over a decade ago. So the earlier Fur Free Fridays would focus on them. Protests outside, you know, handing out leaflets, just raising awareness about the issue and educating the public about the fur industry. More recently, it's been lot of demonstrations trying to convince Nordstrom to go for free, which they finally agreed to this year, which is super exciting. So Nordstrom has agreed to phase out all their fur products by 2021.
By 2021, that is exciting. What kind of fur products were they selling, and are they still selling until 2021?
They always have a very large rack of Canada Goose coats. So that's, which usually just has the coyote fur trim along the hood. And those come from coyotes that were caught in traps, mostly in Canada and the Midwest.
And Canada Goose itself has made a recent announcement about their approach to fur, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Canada Goose has agreed, is shifting to only using recycled fur by 2022, I believe.
And though here in Oregon, there might not be very many outlets for the sale of fur, it actually is a fairly active state in the farming of fur. Isn't that correct?
I think it's ranked fourth or fifth in terms of fur farming in the United States. I believe we have about 12 fur farms in the state, but most of the fur that's produced here is actually sold to China. There isn't a large market for mink coats here.
If you're listening to this episode today on broadcast radio, then today is Friday, November 27th, 2020, which is, in fact, Fur Free Friday. So can you tell us about the events that are coming up today and this weekend?
So today at noon, we'll have a virtual rally with Kelly Peterson of the Humane Society of the United States talking about how to build relationships in the legislative process. And Scott Beckstead of the Center for a Humane Economy talking about mink farms and the spread of COVID-19. Then after the rally, we'll be screening a documentary by We Animals called The Farm in My Backyard, which talks about the effect of water pollution on a community next to a fur farm in Nova Scotia. Then at 5 p.m., we'll be teaming up with ARC-PDX, which is a local animal rights community, to do a virtual action hour, where we'll be outreaching representatives in stores that sell fur and educating them about the danger of the fur trade and the current legislative efforts to help.
And if people want to be a part of any or all of these events, how can they access them?
You can find more information about Fur Free Friday and Compassionate PDX's Fur Free Oregon campaign at compassionatepdx.org.
So what is the relationship between fur farming and maybe factory farming more generally and the current COVID-19 crisis and perhaps past epidemics as well?
It's gradually been reported widely in the media that mink are very susceptible to catching COVID-19. The virus has already spread to hundreds of farms throughout Europe in five different countries. So there's the fear that these farms could become like reservoirs for the virus and continuing to infect humans. So to that end, Spain has already culled 100,000 mink, and the Netherlands is set to cull 17 million. There's also the issue that the mink farms, the virus actually mutated when it went from humans to mink and back to humans. I believe there's five different clusters of the virus. The mutated virus has already infected 200 people in Europe. And the fear is that it could make any vaccine ineffective. And the COVID-19 has already spread through mink farms in three US states, Utah, Michigan, and Wisconsin. But one of the messages that's often being left out of the whole conversation is that the origin of this virus is really, animal exploitation. It's humans finding wild animals and, exploiting them and eating them. That was the original source. And factory farms are breeding grounds for disease. You have lots of animals in close, cramped proximity in damp and dirty conditions. So it's a well-known problem on a lot of fur farms. One example is the annual badger cull in the United Kingdom. Basically, the cattle get tuberculosis and it is spread to local badger populations. So they cull all the cattle, but the problem is that the badgers can still reinfect the cattle because they also have the disease. So every year they have like an annual badger cull in the UK just to try to prevent the disease from spreading back. Another example is, the mad cow scare back in the 90s, a prion disease that infects cattle was killing them. And when the cattle would die from the disease, they would grind their bodies up and feed them back to the other cattle. And then that would spread the disease, which would then spread to humans.
It's heartening to hear of recent victories like Nordstrom pledging to go fur free by 2021 and Canada Goose no longer using virgin fur after 2022. But obviously there's still a lot of work left to be done. Can you tell us more about the fur industry and what the future might hold in terms of campaigns that make the world a better place for humans and for the animals?
The fur industry, many people already know, is incredibly cruel. The animals that are kept in these cages are wild. The most common species farmed for their fur are mink, foxes, and raccoon dogs, but dogs and cats are also farmed in certain locations. The wild species in particular, you know, they have natural ranges of several square kilometers, and they're kept in cages that are barely, you know, a few feet wide. And that leads to cage psychosis. So that means frantic pacing, self-harm, attacking others in their cage, a host of different psychological issues associated with, you know, being kept in confinement like that. And they're also, you know, killed in very cruel and inhumane ways, often gassed to death at a very young age, usually after just 8 months of life. And then the rest of animals killed for their fur is through trapping. So it's coyotes often. These animals will be trapped and stuck in traps for days often, you know, without food or water before they're killed. And it's also it's a very superficial fashion accessory. Most clothing containing fur retails for hundreds, if not thousands of dollars. You know, it's unnecessary in this day and age. We have plenty of textiles that fashion designers can use that don't harm animals.
And actually just received news that might be heartening to those in your community and trying to campaign against the fur industry. Apparently Copenhagen Fur, one of the world's largest markets for animal pelts, will be shutting down by 2023.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm glad to hear more people are waking up to the cruelty this industry has.
Well, thank you very much, Matthew Cooper, for joining us today from Compassionate PDX. Again, if you're listening to this broadcast on the radio, it is Friday, November 27th, and today you have the opportunity to be a part of or to join some of the events going on for the Fur Free Friday and the weekend. And you can learn about that where?
You can learn more information about the fur industry and Fur Free Friday at compassionatepdx.org.
All right. Thank you again, Matthew Cooper. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Noah.
You are listening to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. On today's show, we are also featuring some excerpts from an interview between activist Ed Winters, a.k.a. Earthling Ed, and Michael Greger, M.D. Dr. Greger is the founder of NutritionFacts.org and has a background in both infectious and chronic diseases. This interview is titled, Can We Stop a Future Pandemic?
Predicting that there's going to be another pandemic is like predicting the sun's going to come up the next day. It's always when, never if. But then the next question is, how bad? We got off lucky last time with the 2009 swine flu pandemic. It was only a Category 1 pandemic, only about 500,000 people died. We may not be so lucky next time.
Yeah, absolutely. And so with the current pandemic, it's obviously been traced, or likely has been traced back to the meat market in Wuhan. Now, I was in the US a couple of years ago, and I came across these kind of live animal markets in Brooklyn. There's also some in Texas when I was there. What's the likelihood of something similar originating from one of these live animal markets in somewhere like the US?
You know, it's easy for us kind of xenophobic Westerners to kind of poo-poo these, you know, back alley wet markets in Asia. But for example, the last pandemic was largely made in the USA from industrial pork production facilities in the United States. And there are these live bird markets, particularly in the Northeast, also California here in the States, that have had concerning outbreaks of this these H7 viruses, which have infected people. There was a New Yorker infected in 2003. Then in 2015, shelter cats across New York became infected with this bird flu virus that was found on those live animal markets. One of the veterinarians, one of the shelter workers also got infected. So this is a human adapted virus, has not yet acquired the necessary mutations to transmit human to human effectively, which would trigger the next pandemic. But certainly live markets anywhere, Asia, the United States, Europe, anywhere else, are risk factors, and they should all be shut down. I think it's important to realize that even now in China, when supposedly these live markets are shut down, no, they just shut down the raising of wildlife meat. So the wildlife trade for fur still ongoing. Wildlife trade for traditional Chinese medicines still ongoing. Can still raise these animals, slaughter these animals, sell these animals, but just not for meat. And all farm animals are exempted. In fact, they even went in and changed the definition of like frogs and turtles to livestock, to farm animals, so they can continue to market them. Until 2002, we thought all coronaviruses could do was cause the common cold. So we knew they were transmissible from person to person, but they just caused the sniffles. Then, boom, 2002, SARS emerges from these wet markets, these civet cats being raised in Guangdong province in China, in South China. And all of a sudden, spreads around the world to over 20 countries. Infects, you know, about 8,000 people, 800 of which die. This is about a 10% mortality rate. All of a sudden, coronaviruses could be deadly. We had no idea. And then the thought is, well, wait a second. If it can be transmissible and deadly, well, then there's no reason that this class of coronaviruses couldn't then trigger a global pandemic. And we got another warning call in 2012 with the emergence of MERS linked to intensive camel farming in the Middle East. Another deadly coronavirus disease killed about 1 in 3. We kept having warning sign after warning sign, but of course, we didn't listen. And in fact, the wildlife markets were shut down after SARS in China, but poorly enforced, rapidly reopened, and civet cats were back on the menu within months. And so similarly, the current wildlife ban in China is still only set to be temporary, as these whopping loopholes. If we don't permanently change the way we interact with animals, then we are just going to look at more and more pandemics coming down the pike. I mean, we are in an unprecedented era in human history. We've had dozens of newly emerging and re-emerging diseases, most of which coming from animals. You know, the AIDS virus, blamed on the bushmeat trade in Africa, killing chimpanzees. We have SARS and COVID-19 for the wildlife trade, these live animal markets. We have, you know, swine flu, mad cow, when we started these cannibalistic feeding practices. You know, the deadliest plague in history was a bird flu virus that emerged from the trenches in World War I to kill 50 million people in the pandemic of 1918. But from a virus standpoint, we have those same trench warfare conditions today in every industrial chicken shed, in every industrial egg operation, confined, crowded, stressed, but by the billions, not just millions. And now, as you said, we have viruses H5N1, H7N9, that could kill millions around the globe if they lock in those necessary mutations. Right now, the CDC considers H7N9, which rose to ascendance in 2013, killing about 40% of the people infected, as our greatest pandemic risk. They recently released a threat scenario suggesting millions of Americans could die with an H7N9 pandemic. And so the silver lining here of COVID-19 is that hopefully the world will wake up and look around after millions of lives lost, billions locked down, trillions of dollars lost around the world, finally sit down and take very seriously what those of us in this movement have been saying forever, and that is we need to accelerate the movement towards plant-based milks, plant-based meats, plant-based egg products, not just for human health, for chronic disease sake, not just for global warming. Global health is taking a whole nother view now. Now there's pandemic risk as well. And so we just need to move away towards healthier products, healthier for ourselves, healthier for future generations, and healthier in terms of reducing the risk of pandemic infectious disease. Can't emphasize enough the risk that the world is taking. It may hopefully won't come to this, but we don't tend to shore up the levees until after a disaster, and it may take a pandemic that wipes out millions of people before the world realizes the true cost of cheap chicken.
So why don't we take it more seriously as a risk?
Well, because there are very important moneyed interests involved. So, for example, here in the States, we continue to feed millions of pounds of medically important antibiotics to farm animals by the truckload, something that every single human health organization on the planet is allied against. You say, wait a second, if every public health group on the planet says it's not a good idea to be feeding these critically important drugs to animals just to fatten them faster for slaughter, then why isn't it be done? Why hasn't it been done? Because they're going up against two of the most powerful industries, the pharmaceutical industry that sells all these drugs, and Big Ag, the animal agriculture industries. They have so much power hold, so much a stranglehold over our political system that even things that are just so slam dunk, common sense, scientific consensus, people are dying, are being consistently ignored. But again, there's the silver lining with COVID-19. Hopefully we'll get a pandemic that's just bad enough that people will pay attention so that an even worse pandemic can be prevented in the future. But of course, not bad enough. The minimum amount of suffering that will actually get us to prevent an even larger amount of suffering later on.
That was Dr. Michael Greger speaking on the relationship between animal agriculture and infectious disease prevention. This has been Noah Bristol with Voices for the Animals. Bye.
The preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Film at 11 here on Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Today we look at an old art house standby and at the roots of a new Disney film and a new book on a Kurosawa movie. But first, we discuss a brand new Criterion release. Given that Johnny Dao, or as he is known elsewhere, Johnny Dao Kaifeng, has made 72 movies so far, it might seem odd that the Criterion Collection chose for its debut Johnny Dao film, Throwdown, a romantic friendship comedy drama that can be a challenge to Western viewers. Yet, it turns out the film is not only Johnny Dao's favorite among his own work, but it has distinct links to Akira Kurosawa, both as a dedicatee of the film and inspiration for the movie's philosophical character trajectory. Set in a Hong Kong of neon signs, chiaroscuro nightclubs, and packed gambling parlors, Throwdown is a character study of three friends, a former judo champion who is now a bar-owning alcoholic and gambling addict, played by Louis Koo. His bar is called After Hours after Scorsese's film, along with an aspiring judo champion, Aaron Kwok, and an ambitious singer, played by Cherry Ying. Throwdown specifically cites Kurosawa's debut feature, Sanshiro Zu-